appreciate them. It was different in the past. But the past is over and forgotten. I've heard matters aren't much better at the Laughing Prince's castle these days. But at least they have Balbulus there. We were all very sorry when the Adderhead gave his daughter our best illuminator to take with her as her dowry. Since then, I'm not allowed to employ more than 2 scribes and 1 illuminator of only average talent. The only copies I can commission are of manuscripts about the Adderhead's ancestors, the mining and working of silver, or the art of war. Last year, when wood ran short again, Firefox even heated the small banqueting hall with my finest books.
Tears came to Taddeo's clouded eyes.
Bring me the books whenever you like, said Mo. The old librarian passed the hem on his dark blue tunic over his eyes.
Oh, yes,
he murmured.
Oh, yes, I will. Thank you.
Then he was gone. Sighing, Mo sat down in the chair that Taddeo had brought him. Very well, he said. Let's get down to work. A book to keep death at bay. What an idea. It's just a pity it's for this butcher. You'll have to help me, Maggie, with the folding, stitching, the pressing. She just nodded. Of course she would help him. There were few things she liked doing better. It felt so familiar watching Mo at work again, setting the parchment straight, folding it, cutting and stitching it. He worked more slowly than usual, and his hand kept going to his chest in the place where Martola had wounded him. But Maggie could tell that carrying out the familiar movements did him good, even if some of the tools were not like those he was used to. The actions had been the same for hundreds of years, in both this world and the other one. After only a few hours, the old chamber had something curiously familiar about it, like a refuge and not just another prison. When twilight began to fall outside, the librarian and a servant brought them a couple of oil lamps. The warm light almost made the dusty room look full of life, for the first time in ages.
It's a long while since any lamps were lit in this room, said Taddeo, putting a second one on the table for Mo.
Who lived in this room last? Asked Mo.
Our first princess, replied Taddeo. Her daughter Violante married the Laughing Prince's son. I wonder if Violante knows that Cosimo has died for the second time.
He looked sadly out the window. A moist wind was blowing in, and Mo weighed the paper down with a piece of wood.
Violante came into the world with a birthmark that disfigured her face,
the librarian went on in an abstracted voice, as if he were telling the story not to them but to some distant hearer.
Everyone said it was a punishment, a curse from the fairies because her mother had fallen in love with a minstrel. The Adderhead had her mother banished to this part of the castle as soon as the baby was born, and she lived here with her daughter until she died. Died very suddenly.
That's a sad story, said Mo.
Believe me,
replied Taddeo bitterly.
If all the sad stories these walls have seen were written down in books, we could fill every room in the castle with them.
Maggie looked around as if she could see all those books of sad stories. How old was Violante when she was betrothed to Cosimo and sent to Umbra? She asked.
7. And the daughters of our present princess were only 6 when they were betrothed and sent away. We all hope she'll have a son this time.
Taddeo let his eyes linger on the paper that Mo had cut to size. The tools.
It's good to see life in this room again, he said quietly. I'll come back with the books as soon as I'm sure that Martola is asleep.
6, 7 years old, my God, Maggie, said Mo when Taddeo had gone. Here you are, 13 already, and I still haven't sent you away, let alone betrothed you to anyone. It felt good to laugh, even if the sound echoed strangely in this high-ceiling room. Taddeo did not come back until hours later. Mo was still working, although he put his hand to his chest more and more often, and Maggie had already tried persuading him once or twice to lie down and sleep. Sleep, was all he said. I haven't slept properly for a single night in this castle. And anyway, I want to see your mother again. And I won't be able to do that until this book is finished. The librarian brought him two volumes.
Look at this,
he whispered, pushing the first over to Mo.
See those places where the binding is eaten away? And inside it, it looks almost as if the ink were rusting. These are holes in the parchment. You can hardly read some of the words now. What could have caused it? Worms? Beetles? I never used to concern myself with these things. I had an assistant who knew all about these sicknesses that books suffer, but one morning he disappeared. They say he joined the robbers in the forest.
Mo picked up the book, opened it, and passed his hand over the pages. Good heavens, he said. Who painted this? I've never seen such beautiful illuminations.
Balbulus, replied Taddeo, the illuminator who was sent away with Violante. He was very young when he painted this book. Look, his script was still a little awkward, but now his mastery is impeccable.
How do you know? Asked Maggie. The librarian lowered his voice.
Violante has a book sent to me now and then. She knows how much I admire the craftsmanship of Balbillus, and she knows there's no one else left in the Castle of Night who loves books. Not since her mother died. Do you see the chests there?
He pointed to the heavy, dusty wooden chests by the door and under the windows.
Violante's mother kept her books in them, hidden among her clothes. She would take them out only in the evening and show them to the little girl, although I suppose the child hardly understood a word of what her mother read her at the time. But then, soon after Capricorn had disappeared, Mortola came here. The Adderhead had asked her to train the maids in the kitchen. No one said what exactly they were to be trained to do. Then Violante's mother asked me to hide her books in the library, because Mortola had her room searched at least twice a day. She never found out what for. This,
he said, pointing to the book that Mo was still leafing through,
was one of her favorites. The little girl would point to a picture, and then her mother told her a story about it. I was going to give it to Violante when they sent her away, but she left it behind in this room. Perhaps because she didn't want to take any memories of this sad place to her new life with her. All the same, I'd like to save it as a memento of her mother. You know, I think that a book always keeps something of its owner's between its pages.
Yes, I think so too, said Mo. I'm sure of it.
And?
The old man looked at him hopefully.
Do you know how it can be preserved from further harm?
Mo carefully closed the book. Yes, but it won't be easy. Woodworm, the corrosive effect of the ink, who knows what else. Does the second book look the same?
Oh, that one.
The librarian cast another nervous look at the door.
Well, it's not in such a bad way yet, but I thought you might like to see it. Balbulus completed it not long ago for Violante. It contains,
he said, looking uncertainly at Mo.
It contains all the songs that the strolling players sing about the blue jay. As far as I know, there are only two copies. Violante owns one, and the other is before you and is a copy that she had specially made for me. They say the man who wrote the songs didn't want them written down, but any minstrel will sing them to you for a few coins. That was how Violante collected them and had them written out by Balbulus. The strolling players, you see. Well, they're like walking books here, where real books are so few and far between. You know, I sometimes think this world would have lost its memory long ago but for the motley folk. Unfortunately, the Adderhead is only too fond of hanging them. I've often suggested sending a scribe to see them before they're executed to get all those beautiful songs written down before the words die with them. But no one in this castle listens to an old librarian.
No, very likely not, murmured Mo. But Maggie could tell from his voice that he hadn't been listening to anything Tadeo had said. Mo was immersed in the letters, the beautiful written characters flowing over the parchment in front of him like a delicate river of ink.
Forgive my curiosity.
Tadeo cleared his throat, embarrassed.
I've heard that you deny being the Blue Jay. But if you will allow me...
He took the book from Mo's hand and opened it at a page that Balbulus had illuminated lavishly. A man stood between two trees, so wonderfully painted that Maggie thought she could hear the rustle of the leaves. He wore a bird mask over his face.
That's how Balbulus painted the Blue Jay, whispered Tadeo. Just as the songs describe him, dark-haired, tall. Doesn't he look like you?
I don't know, said Mo. He's wearing a mask, isn't he?
Yes, yes, indeed.
Tadeo was still looking intently at him.
But did you know that they say something else about the Blue Jay? They say he has a very beautiful voice, not at all like the bird that shares his name. It's said that he can tame bears and wolves with a few words. Forgive me for being so forward, but...
He lowered his voice to a conspiratorial tone.
You have a very beautiful voice. Mortola tells strange tales of it. And then... When you have the scar, too.
He stared at Mo's arm. Oh, you mean this, don't you? Mo placed his finger under a line beside which Balbulus had painted a pack of white dogs in red. High on his left arm, he will bear the scar to his dying day. Yes, I do have a scar like that, but I didn't get it from the dogs in this song. He put his hand to his arm, as if remembering the day when Basta found them in the tumble-down hut full of broken pots and tiles. However, the old librarian took a step back.
So, you are him,
he breathed.
The hope of the poor, the terror of butchers, avenger and robber, as much at home in the forest as the bears and wolves.
Mo shut the book and pressed the metal clasps into the leather-covered binding. No, he said. No, I'm not, but thank you very much for the book all the same. It's a long time since I had one in my hands, and it will be good to have something to read again, won't it, Maggie?
Yes, was all she said, taking the book from his hand. Songs about the Blue Jay. What would Fenoglio have said if he'd known that Violante had had them written down in secret? And they might offer so much help. Her heart leaped as she thought of the possibilities, but Tadeo immediately dashed her hopes.
I'm very sorry, he said, taking the book gently but firmly from her hands again, but I can't leave either of the books here with you. Mortola has been talking to me, to everyone who has anything to do with the library. She's threatened to have anyone who so much as brings a book into this room blinded. Blinded, imagine it. What a threat. When only our eyes revealed the world of words to us. I've already risked far too much coming here with them at all. But I love those books so much that I had to ask your advice. Please, tell me what I must do to save them.
Maggie was so disappointed that she would have turned down his request point blank. But of course, Mo saw things differently. Mo thought only of the sick books. Of course, he said to Tadeo. I'd better write it down for you. It will take time, weeks, months, and I don't know if you'll be able to get all the materials you need, but it's worth a try. I'm not happy about suggesting this, but I'm afraid you'll have to take apart at least the first book, because if you're to save it, the pages must bleach in the sun. If you don't know how to go about it, and it must be done with the utmost care, I'd be happy to do it for you. Mortola can watch if she wants to make sure I'm not doing anything dangerous.
Oh, thank you.
The old man bowed
deeply as he put the two books firmly under his thin arm.
Many, many thanks. And I really do most fervently hope the Adderhead will let you live, and if he doesn't, that he grants you a quick death.
Maggie would very much like to give him the answer this remark deserved, but Taddeo scurried away too fast on his grasshopper legs.
"Mo, don't you help him,"
she said when the guard outside had bolted the door again.
"Why should you? He's a miserable coward."
"Oh, I can understand him," said Mo. "I wouldn't like to do without my eyes either, even though we have useful inventions like Braille in our own world.
All the same, I wouldn't help him."
Maggie loved her father for his strangely soft heart, but her own could not summon up any sympathy for Taddeo. She imitated his voice.
"I hope he grants you a quick death.
How can anyone say such a thing?"
But Mo wasn't listening. "Have you ever seen such beautiful books, Maggie?" he asked, lying down on the bed.
"You bet I have," she said indignantly. "Any book I'm allowed to read is more beautiful, right?"
But Mo did not reply. He turned his back to her, and was breathing deeply and peacefully. Obviously, sleep had found its way to him, at last.
Chapter 67 Kindness and Mercy.
"When are we going back?" Farid asked Dustfinger this question several times today, and every time he got the same answer, "Not yet."
"But we've been here so long.
It was almost 2 weeks since the bloodbath in the forest, and he was sick and tired of hanging around in the badger's earth."
"What about Negi? You promised we'd go back."
All Dustfinger said to that was,
"If you go on pressing me so hard, I shall forget that promise."
Then he went to Roxanne. She was busy day and night, nursing the wounded they had found among the dead, in the hope that at least these few would return to Ombra, but some of them she tended in vain. "He will stay with her," thought Farid every time he saw Dustfinger sitting beside her, "and I'll have to go back to the Castle of Night alone." The thought hurt like fire biting him. On the 15th day, when Farid felt he would never be able to wash the smell of mouse droppings and pale mushrooms off his skin, two of the Black Prince's informers brought identical news. The Adderhead's wife had borne him a son. To celebrate this event, so his criers were announcing in every marketplace, in exactly 2 weeks' time he would show his great kindness and mercy by setting free all the prisoners held in the dungeons of the Castle of Night, including the Blue Jay.
"Nonsense," said Dustfinger, when Farid had told him about it. "The Adderhead has a roast quail where other people have a heart. He would never set anyone free out of mercy, however many sons were born to him. No. If he really intends to let them go, it's because Finolio wrote it that way, and for no other reason."
Finolio seemed to share this opinion. Ever since the bloodbath, he had spent most of his time sitting in some dark corner of the badger's earth, looking gloomy and scarcely saying a word. But now he started defiantly announcing to anyone who would listen that the good news was due solely to him. No one took any notice of him. No one knew what he was talking about, except for Dustfinger, who was still avoiding him like the plague in human form.
"Listen to the old man. Listen how he boasts and brags," he said to Farid. "Cosimo and his men are hardly cold in the ground, and he's forgotten them already. I hope he drops dead himself."
The Black Prince, of course, believed in the Adderhead's mercy as little as Dustfinger did, in spite of Finolio's assurances that exactly what the informers had said would really happen. The robbers sat together until late into the night, discussing what to do. They would not let Farid join this council, but Dustfinger was with them.
"What's their plan? Tell me,"
Farid asked him when he finally came back from the cave where the robbers had been putting their heads together for hours on end.
"They're going to set out in a week's time."
"Wherefore, the Castle of Night?"
"Yes."
Dustfinger didn't seem half as pleased as he was.
"Good heavens, you're fidgeting like fire when the wind blows into it," he snapped at Farid irritably. "We'll see if you're still so happy once we get there. We'll have to crawl underground like worms and go much deeper there than here."
"Even deeper?" "But of course." Farid pictured Mount Adder before him. There wasn't anywhere to hide. Not a bush, not a tree.
"There's an abandoned mine at the foot of the north slope."
Dustfinger made a face, as if the mere thought of the place turned his stomach. "Some ancestor of the Adderhead must have dug too deep there, and several galleries fell in,
but that's so long ago that obviously not even the Arrowhead himself remembers the mine. Not a pleasant place, but a good hideout, and the only one on Mount Adder. The bear found the entrance.
A mine?
Farid swallowed. The thought of it left him struggling for air.
Then what? He asked. What do we do when we get there?
Wait. Wait to see if the Otterhead really keeps his promise.
Wait? Is that all?
You'll learn everything else soon enough.
Then we're going too?
Did you have anything else in mind? Farid hugged him more tightly than he had for a long time, even though he knew that Dustfinger did not particularly like to be hugged.
No,
said Roxanne when the Black Prince offered to have her escorted back to Ombra by one of his men before they set out.
I'm coming with you. If you can spare a man, then send him to my children to tell them I'll be home soon.
Soon? Farid wondered exactly when that was going to be, but he said nothing. Although the time when they would set out was now fixed, the days still passed terribly slowly, and almost every night he dreamed of Maggie. Those were bad dreams, full of darkness and fear. When the day of their departure finally came, half a dozen robbers stayed in the Badger's Earth to go on tending the wounded. The rest set out on the road to the Castle of Night. 30 men in ragged clothing, but well-armed. And Roxanne. And Finolio.
You're taking the old man, too?
Dustfinger asked the prince in astonishment when he saw Finolio among the men.
Are you crazy? Send him back to Ombra. Take him anywhere else, straight to the white women for preference, but send him away.
However, the prince wouldn't hear of it. What do you have against him? He asked. He's a harmless old man, and don't start telling me again how he can bring the dead to life. Even my bear likes him. He's written us some fine songs, and he can tell wonderful stories, even if he has no appetite for them just now. And he doesn't want to go back to Ombra anyway. I'm not surprised, considering all the widows and orphans he's made there, said Dustfinger bitterly. And when Finolio looked his way, he cast him so icy a glance that the old man quickly turned his head again. It was a silent march. The trees whispered above their heads, as if warning them not to take a step farther south. And once or twice Dustfinger had to summon fire to chase away beings that none of them could see, although they sensed them. Farid was tired, tired to death. His face and his arms all scratched with thorns by the time the silver towers finally appeared above the treetops.
Like a crown on a bald head, whispered one of the robbers.
And for a moment, Farid felt he could physically grasp the fear that these ragged men felt at the sight of the mighty fortress. No doubt they were all glad when the prince led them to the north slope of Mount Adder, and the tops of the towers disappeared again. The earth fell in folds like a crumpled garment on this side of the hill, and the few trees cowered low as if they heard the sound of axes too often. Farid had never seen such trees before. Their leaves seemed as black as night itself, and their bark was prickly like a hedgehog. Red berries grew on the branches.
Mortola's berries,
Dustfinger whispered to him as he picked a handful in passing.
She said to have scattered them everywhere at the foot of this hill, until they were sprinkled all over the ground. The trees grow very fast. They shoot up from the earth like mushrooms and keep all other trees away. Bitterberry trees, they're called. Everything about them is poisonous. The berries and their leaves. And the bark burns the skin worse than fire.
Farid dropped the berries and wiped his hand on his trousers.
A little later, when it was pitch dark, they almost ran into one of the patrols that the Adder had regularly sent out, but the bear warned them in time. The mounted men appeared among the trees like silver beetles. Moonlight was reflected on their breastplates, and Farid hardly dared to breathe as he ducked down into a crevice in the ground with Dustfinger and Roxanne, waiting for the hoofbeats to die away. They stole on, like mice under the eyes of a cat, until they had finally reached their goal. Wild vines and rubble hid the entrance. The prince was the first to force his way down into the bowels of the earth. Farid hesitated when he saw how steep the climb down into the darkness looked.
Come on, whispered Dustfinger impatiently. The sun will soon rise, and the outer soldiers aren't going to mistake you for a squirrel.
But it smells like a burial vault, said Farid as he looked longingly up at the sky.
The boy has a good nose, said Snapper before pushing his way past him grim-faced.
Yes,
There are many dead men down there. The mountain devoured them because they dug too deep. You don't see them, but you smell them. People say they stop up the galleries like a cargo of dead fish.
Horrified, Farid looked at him, but Dustfinger just pushed him in the back.
Look, how often do I have to tell you it's not the dead but the living you should fear? Come on, make a few sparks dance on your fingertips to give us a light.
The robbers had settled in those galleries that were not buried in rubble. They had given the roofs and walls additional props, but Farid didn't trust the beams now braced against the stone in the ground. How could they support the weight of a whole mountain? He thought he heard it sighing and groaning, and while he made himself as comfortable as he could on the dirty blankets that the robbers had spread on the hard ground, he suddenly remembered Sutbert again. But the prince only laughed when he anxiously asked about him.
No, Sutbert doesn't know about this place or any of our hideouts. He's often tried to get us to take him along, but who's going to trust such a wretched fire-eater? The only reason he knew about the secret camp was because he's one of the strolling players. All the same, Farid did not feel safe. Almost a week yet to go before the Adderhead freed his prisoners. It would be a long wait. He was already wishing himself back among the mouse droppings in the badger's earth. During the night he kept staring at the rubble closing off the galleries where they were sleeping. He thought he heard pale fingers scraping at the stones.
"Put your hands over your ears, then,"
was all Dustfinger said when Farid shook him awake to say so. And he put his arms around Roxanne again. Dustfinger was having bad dreams, the kind he had often had in the other world. But now it was Roxanne who calmed him and whispered him back to sleep. Her quiet voice, soft with love, reminded Farid of Meggie's. And he missed Meggie so much that he felt ashamed of his weakness. In this darkness surrounded by the dead, it was difficult to believe that she was missing him, too.
Suppose she had forgotten him, the way Dustfinger often forgot him now that Roxanne was here. Only Meggie had made him forget his jealousy. But Meggie wasn't with him now. On the second night, a boy came to the mine. He worked in the stables of the Castle of Night and had been spying for the Black Prince ever since the Piper had his brother hanged. He said that the Adderhead would let the prisoners go along the road leading down to the harbor on condition that they boarded a ship there and never returned. The road to the harbor, huh, was all the prince said when the informer had gone again. And he set out with Dustfinger that same night. Farid didn't ask if he could go too. He simply followed them. The road was little more than a footpath leading through the trees. It ran straight down Mount Adder, as if in a hurry to slip under the canopy of leaves. The Adder had pardoned a troop of prisoners once before and let them go along this road, said the prince when they were under the trees at the roadside. And they did reach the sea without mishap, just as he had promised. But the ship waiting for them was a slave ship. And they say the Adder had got a particularly fine silver bridle for those prisoners. A scant dozen of them.
Slaves!
Farid remembered markets where people were sold, and buyers gaped at them, and felt them as if they were cattle. Girls with blonde hair had been in great demand.
"Don't look as if Maggie has been sold already," said Dustfinger. "The prince'll think of something, won't you?"
The Black Prince tried to smile, but he couldn't conceal the fact that he was eyeing the road with great concern.
"They must never reach that ship," he said. "And we can only hope that the Adderhead doesn't send too many soldiers to escort them. We must hide them quickly. In the mine at first. That will be best. Until everything's quieted down again. And very likely," he added almost as an afterthought, "we shall need fire."
Dustfinger blew on his fingers until flames as delicate as butterfly wings were dancing there.
"What do you think I'm still here for?" he asked. "Fire there shall be, but I will not take a sword in my hand in case that's what you're hoping. You know I'm no good with such things."
Chapter 68 A Visit. When Meggie woke, she didn't know for a moment where she was. In Eleanor's house? She wondered. With Fenolia? But then she saw Mo bending low over the big table, binding a book. The book. 500 blank pages.
They were in the Castle of Night, and Mo was to have the book finished tomorrow. A flash of lightning illuminated the soot-blackened ceiling, and the thunder that followed sounded menacingly loud. But it wasn't the storm that had woken Maggie. She had heard voices. The guards. There was someone at the door. Mo had heard it too.
Maggie, he mustn't work such long hours. It could bring back the fever.
The barn owl had told her that very morning before they took him down to the dungeons again. But what could she do about it? Mo sent her to bed the moment she began yawning too often. That was the 23rd yawn, Maggie. Go on, bed for you, or you'll be dead on your feet before this damn book is finished. Then it would be ages before he went to sleep himself. He stayed up cutting, folding, and stitching until it was nearly dawn. He'd done that tonight as well. When one of the guards opened the door, Maggie thought for a dreadful moment that Mortola had come to kill Mo after all, before the Adderhead let him go. But it was not the magpie. The Adderhead stood in the doorway, breathing heavily. Two servants stood behind him, their faces pale with exhaustion, carrying silver candelabras from which wax dripped to the floorboards. Their master, treading heavily, approached the table at which Mo worked and stared at the book. It was almost finished. "What are you doing here?" Mo still had the paper knife in his hand. The Adderhead stared at him. His eyes were even more bloodshot than on the night when Maggie had made her bargain with him. "How much longer?" he demanded. "My son is crying. He cries all night. He feels the white women coming close, just as I do. Now they want to fetch him away, too, him and me at the same time. Folks say they're particularly hungry on stormy nights." Mo put down the knife. "The book will be finished tomorrow, as agreed. It would have been ready sooner, but the leather to cover it was full of tears and holes made by thorns. So that held us up. And the paper wasn't as good as it might have been either."
"Yes, yes, very well. The librarian has passed on your complaints."
The Adderhead's voice sounded as if he had been shouting himself hoarse.
"If Taddeo had his way, you'd spend the rest of your life in this room, rebinding all my books. But I will let you go. You, your daughter, your wife, and those good-for-nothing strolling players. They can all go. I just want the book. Mortola has told me about the three words that your daughter so cunningly failed to mention, but never mind that. I shall take good care that no one writes them in its pages. I want to be able to laugh in the cold man's face at last. Laugh at him and his pale women. Another night like this and I shall be beating my head against the wall. I shall kill my wife. I shall kill my child. I shall kill all of you. Do you understand, Blue Jay, or whatever your name is? You must finish the book before dark falls again. You must."
Mo stroked the wooden boards that he had covered with leather only the day before. "I'll be finished by the time the sun rises, but you must swear to me on your son's life that then you will let us go at once." The Adderhead looked at him as if the white women were standing behind him.
"Yes, yes, I swear by whoever, whatever you like. By sunrise, that sounds good."
He walked ponderously over to Mo and stared at his chest.
"Show me," he whispered. "Show me where Mortola wounded you. With the magic weapon that my master-at-arms took apart so thoroughly that now no one can put it together again. I had the fool hanged for that."
Mo hesitated, but finally he opened his shirt. So close to the heart. The Adderhead put his hand on Mo's chest as if to make sure that the heart was really still beating. "Yes," he said. "Yes, you must indeed know a way to cheat death, or you wouldn't be alive now." He turned abruptly and waved the two servants over to the door. "Very well, I shall have you fetched soon after sunrise. You and the book," he said over his shoulder.
"Now get me something to eat in the hall,"
Maggie heard him shouting outside the door as the guards bolted it again.
"Wake the cooks! Wake the maids and the piper. Wake them all. I want to eat and listen to a few dark songs, and the piper must sing them so loudly that I don't hear the child crying."
Then his footsteps retreated, and only the rolling of the thunder remained. A flash of lightning made the pages of the almost-finished book shine as if they had a life of their own. Mo had gone over to the window. He stood there motionless, looking out.
"By sunrise, can you do it?" asked Maggie anxiously.
"Of course," he said without turning. Lightning was flickering over the sea like a distant light being switched on and off by someone, except that no such light existed in this world. Maggie went over to Mo and he put his arm around her. He knew she was afraid of thunderstorms. When she was very small and had crept into bed with him, he always told her the same story. Thunderstorms were because the sky longed to be united with the earth and reached out fiery fingers to touch it on such nights. But Mo didn't tell that story today.
"Did you see the fear in his face?" Maggie whispered to him. "Exactly as Fidelio described it."
"Yes. Even the adder head must play the part that Fidelio has written for him," replied Mo. "But so must we, Maggie. How do you like that idea?"
Chapter 69 The Night Before. It was the last night before the day when the adder head would show his clemency. In a few hours, just before dawn, they would all be in position by the road. None of the informers had been able to say exactly when the prisoners were to come down it. They knew only that this would be the day. The robbers were sitting together, telling one another tales of old adventures in loud voices. Presumably that was their means of keeping fear at bay. But Dustfinger did not feel like either talking or listening. He kept waking suddenly from sleep, but not because of the voices that came to his ears. Pictures in his mind woke him, terrible pictures that had been robbing him of sleep for days. This time they had been particularly bad, and so real that he started up as if Gwyn had jumped on his chest. His heart was still thudding hard as he sat there staring into the dark. Dreams. In the other world, they had often kept him from sleeping, too. But they couldn't remember any of them as bad as this one. "It's the dead. They bring bad dreams," Farid always said. "They whisper terrible things to you, and then they lie on your breast to feel your racing heart. It makes them feel alive again." Dustfinger liked this explanation. He feared death, but not the dead. But suppose it was quite different. Suppose the dreams were showing him a story already waiting for him somewhere. Reality was a fragile thing. Silvertongue's voice had shown him that once and for all. Roxanne stirred in her sleep beside him. She turned her head and murmured the names of her children, the dead as well as the living. There was still no news from Ombra. Even the Black Prince had heard nothing for a long time, either from the castle or the city. No word of what had happened after the Adder Head sent Cosimo's body back to his daughter, with the news that hardly any of them who had followed him would come back either. Roxanne whispered Brianna's name again. Every day she stayed here with him cut her to the heart. Dustfinger knew that only too well. So why didn't he simply go back with her? Why not turn his back on this infernal hill and return at last to a place where you didn't have to hide underground like an animal? Or like a dead man, he added in his thoughts. "You know why," he told himself. "It's the dreams, the accursed dreams." He whispered fire words to banish the darkness in which dreams put forth such dreadful blossoms. A flame licked up sleepily from the ground beside him. He held out his hand and let it dance up his arm, lick his fingers and his forehead, in the hope that it would simply burn away the horrible pictures. But even the pain did not rid him of them, and Dustfinger extinguished the flame with the flat of his hand. His skin was sooty and hot afterward, as if the fire had left its black breath behind, but the dream was still there. A terror in his heart, too black and strong even for the fire. How could he simply go away when he saw such images by night? Pictures of the dead, again and again, nothing but blood and death. The faces changed. Sometimes it was Reese's face he saw, sometimes Maggie's, then at other times the face of the barn owl. He had seen the Black Prince, too, with blood on his breast. And today it had been Farid's face, just like the night before.
Dustfinger closed his eyes when the pictures came back, so plain and clear. Of course he had tried to persuade the boy to stay with Roxanne tomorrow when he set off with the robbers. Along the road they were to come down, Risa and Silvertongue, Maggie, the barn owl, and all the others. Just how many there would be, even the prince's informers could not say. But it was hopeless. Dustfinger leaned back against the damp stone into which hands long gone had cut the narrow galleries, and looked at the boy. Farid had curled up like a small child, knees drawn up against his chest, with the two martens beside him. They slept at Farid's side more and more often when they came back from hunting, perhaps because they knew that Roxanne did not like them. How peacefully the boy lay there. Not at all as Dustfinger had just seen him in his dreams. A smile even flickered across his dark face. Perhaps he was dreaming of Maggie, Reese as Maggie. As like her mother as one flame is like another, and yet so different.
You do think she's all right, don't you?
Farid asked that question heaven knows how many times a day. Dustfinger still clearly remembered the feeling of being in love for the first time. How vulnerable his heart had suddenly been. Such a trembling, quivering thing. Happy, and miserably unhappy at once. A cold wind blew through the galleries, and Dustfinger saw the boy shivering in his sleep. Gwyn raised his head when he rose and took the cloak off his shoulders, covering Farid with it.
"Why are you looking at me like that?" he whispered to the marten. "He's crept into your heart just as he's crept into mine. How could it happen to us, Gwyn?"
The marten licked his paw and looked at him from dark eyes. When he dreamed, it was surely only of hunting, not of dead boys. Suppose the old man was sending the dreams? The idea made Dustfinger shudder as he lay down beside Roxanne on the hard ground again. Yes, Finolio could be sitting in some corner, as he had often done these last few days, spinning bad dreams for him. That was exactly what he had done with the Adderhead's fears.
Nonsense, thought Dustfinger angrily,
putting his arm around Roxanne.
Maggie isn't here. Without her, the old man's words are nothing but ink. I'll try to get some sleep. He'll be nodding off as you wait among the trees with the others tomorrow.
But it was a long time before he could close his eyes. He just lay there and listened to the boy's breathing.
Chapter 70 The Pen and the Sword. Mo worked all night, while the storm raged outside as if Finolio's world would not acknowledge the arrival of immortality into it. Maggie had tried to stay awake, but finally she had nodded off again, head on the table, and he had put her to bed as he had done so many times before, marveling yet again to see how big she was now. Almost grown up. Almost. Maggie woke as he snapped the clasps shut. "Good morning," he said as she raised her head from the pillow, and hoped it would really be a good morning. Outside the sky was turning red like a face with the blood streaming back into it. The clasps held well. Mo had filed them so that no part of them pricked or dug into the fingers. They held the blank pages together as firmly as if death were already between them. The leather he had been given for the binding had a reddish tinge, and it surrounded the wooden boards of the covers like their natural skin. The back was gently rounded, the stitching firm, and the quires carefully planed. But the fact was that none of that mattered with this book. No one would read it. No one would keep it beside his bed to leaf through its pages again and again. The book was eerie for all its beauty. Even Mo felt that, although it was the work of his own hands. It seemed to have a voice that whispered barely perceptible words, words that were not to be found on its blank pages. But they existed. Finolio had written them, in a place far away, where women and children now wept for their dead husbands and fathers. Yes, the clasps were important. Heavy footsteps echoed along the corridor outside the door. Soldiers' footsteps. They came closer and closer. Outside, the night was fading. The Adderhead was taking Mo at his word.
"By the time the sun rises."
Maggie quickly got out of bed, passed her hand over her hair, and smoothed down her creased dress.
"Is it finished?"
she whispered. He nodded and took the book from the table.
"Do you think the Adderhead will like it?"
The piper opened the door, with four men following him. His silver nose sat on his face as if it had grown from the flesh.
"Well, Blue Jay, have you finished?"
Mo inspected the book from all sides.
Yes, I think so, he said.
But when the piper put out his hand, he hid it behind his back.
"Oh, no,"
he said. "I'm keeping this until your master has kept his side of the bargain."
"You are,"
the piper smiled in derision.
"Don't you think I know ways of taking it from you? But hold on to it for a while. Fear will make you weak at the knees soon enough."
It was a long way from the part of the castle of night where the ghosts of forgotten women lived, to the halls where the Adderhead held court. The piper walked behind Mo all the way with his curiously arrogant gait, stiff as a stork, so close behind that Mo felt his breath on the nape of his neck. Mo had never been in most of the corridors along which they marched, yet he felt as if he had walked down them all before, in the days when he read Finolio's book over and over again, as he tried to bring Risa back. It was a strange feeling to be here himself, behind the words on the page, and looking for her again. He had read about the hall whose mighty doors opened for them too, and when he saw Maggie's look of alarm, he knew only too well what other dreadful place it reminded them both of. Capricorn's red church had not been half as magnificent as the Adderhead's throne room. But thanks to Finolio's description, Mo had recognized the model at once. Red-washed walls, column ranged beside column on both sides, except that, unlike those in Capricorn's church, these were faced with scales of silver. Capricorn had even taken the idea of a statue from the Adderhead, but the sculptor who immortalized the silver prince clearly knew his trade better. Capricorn had not tried to imitate the Adderhead's throne. It was in the shape of a nest of silver vipers, two of them rearing up with their mouths fixed and wide open so that the Adderhead's hands could rest on their heads. The lord of the castle of night was magnificently clad, despite the early hour, as if to welcome his immortality with due honor. He wore a cape of silvery white heron feathers over garments of black silk. Behind him, like a flock of birds with bright plumage, stood his court, administrators, ladies' maids, servants, and among them, dressed in the ashen gray of their guild, a number of physicians. Mortola was there too, of course. She stood in the background, almost invisible in her black dress. If Mo had not been looking out for her, he would have missed her. There was no sign of Basta, but Firefox was standing next to the throne, arms crossed under his fox fur cloak. He was staring their way with hostility, but to Mo's surprise, his dark looks were aimed not at him, but mainly at the piper. "It's a game," thought Mo as he walked past the silver columns. Finolio's game. If only it hadn't felt so real. How quiet it was in the Red Hall, in spite of all the people. Maggie looked at him, her face so pale under her fair hair, and he gave her the most encouraging smile his lips could manage, feeling thankful that she couldn't hear how fast his heart was beating. The Adderhead's wife sat beside him. Maggie had described her perfectly, an ivory porcelain doll. Behind them stood the nurse with the eagerly awaited son. Mo had never wanted a son, only a daughter. Risa had teased him about it when they didn't yet know what their baby would be. The child's crying sounded strangely lost in the great hall. Even the rain beating against the glazed windows high above them drowned out the shrill little voice. "It's a game," thought Mo once more when he was standing before the steps of the throne. "Only a game." If only he'd known more about the rules. There was someone else present whom they knew. Taddeo the librarian, head humbly bent, stood right behind the Adderhead's throne and gave Mo an anxious smile.
The Adderhead looked even more exhausted for lack of sleep than he had on their last meeting. His face was blotched and full of shadows, his lips colorless. Only the rubies in the corners of his nostrils shone red. Who could say how many sleepless nights he had spent? For a moment, it seemed to Mo as if all his life had gone into the rubies at the corners of his nose.
"Good. So you have really finished," he said. "Of course you're in a hurry to see your wife again, I'm sure. I've been told she asks about you every day. That's love, I expect, isn't it?"
"A game, only a game. It didn't feel like that. Nothing had ever seemed more real than the hatred that Mo felt at this moment, as he looked at that coarse and arrogant face. And he felt something else beating in his breast again, his new, cold heart. Or was it just his old heart, burned out with hatred? The Adderhead made a sign to the piper, and the silver-nosed man stepped commandingly toward Mo. He found it hard to put the book into the man's gloved hands. After all, there was nothing else that could save them now. The piper noticed his reluctance, smiled scornfully at him, and took the book up the steps to his master. Then, with a brief glance at Firefox, he stationed himself right beside the throne with an arrogant air, as if there were no more important man in the hall. "Beautiful, beautiful indeed." The Adderhead caressed the white pages of the book. "Whether or not he's a robber, he knows something about bookbinding. Don't you agree, Firefox?"
"There are men of many trades among the robbers," Firefox replied. "Why not an accursed bookbinder, too?"
"How true."
"Did you all hear that?"
The Adderhead looked at his colorfully clad retinue, inviting approval.
"It seems to me that my herald still thinks I'd have let a little girl trick me. Yes, he believes I'm a credulous fool by comparison with his old master, Capricorn."
Firefox was about to protest, but the Adderhead silenced him with a gesture.
"Do not speak,"
was all he said, loud enough for everyone to hear.
"In spite of my very obvious folly, I have thought of a way to prove which of the two of us is wrong."
With a nod of the head, he summoned Tadeo to his side. Eager to oblige, the librarian approached him, taking a pen and ink from the folds of his flowing robe.
"It's perfectly simple, Firefox."
You could tell that the Adderhead liked the sound of his own voice.
"You, and not I, will be the first to write your name in this book. Tadeo here has assured me that the letters can be removed again with a scraper that Bulbulus once designed specially for that purpose, leaving no trace. No one will be able to see even a shadow of your writing on the pages. So, you write your name, which I know you are able to do. We give the Blue Jay a sword, and he runs it through your body. Isn't that a fabulous idea? Won't it prove beyond doubt whether or not this book can do what his daughter promised me?"
"A game." Mo saw fear spread over Firefox's face like a rash.
"Well, come along,"
the Adderhead derided him, opening the book and leafing through the blank pages as if lost in thought.
"Why do you suddenly look so pale? Isn't such a game precisely to your taste? Come along, write your name in it. Not the name you've given yourself, but the one you were born with."
"Think." Mo saw one of the guards surrounding him and Meggie draw his sword. "What are you going to do? What?" He felt Maggie's horrified gaze, felt her fear like a chill beside him. Firefox looked around as if searching for a face that might offer help. But no one stepped forward. Not even Mortola. She stood there with her lips compressed so tightly that they were almost white. And if her glance could have killed, as her poisons often did, the book would not have helped the Adderhead.
As it was, however, he just smiled at her and put the pen in his herald's hand. Firefox stared at the sharpened quill as if he were not quite sure what to do with it. Then he dipped it ceremoniously in the ink and wrote.
Excellent!
The piper took the book from his hand the moment he had finished. The Adderhead waved to one of the servants waiting with dishes full of fruit and cakes at the foot of the silver columns.
Well, what are you waiting for, Firefox? Try your luck.
Honey dripped from his fingers as he pushed one of the cakes between his lips. Firefox, however, stood there, still staring at the piper, whose long arms were wound around the book as if he were holding a baby. He responded to Firefox's glance with a nasty smile. Firefox abruptly turned his back to him and the Adderhead and came down the steps. Mo removed Maggie's hand from his arm and pushed her gently aside, although she resisted. The men-at-arms standing around retreated, with incredulity on their faces as if clearing a stage. Except for the one who had drawn his sword, and now held it out to Mo. Was this still Finolio's game? It would be like him. When Mo had entered the hall just now, he'd have given one of his eyes for a sword. But he didn't want this one. He wanted it as little as the roles some other people wanted him to play, whether Finolio or the Adderhead. He'd always hated games like this, games played by the strong with someone weaker, the cat with the helpless mouse. He hated them, even when the mouse was a murderer and a fire raiser. When Firefox stopped at the foot of the steps, hesitating as if he were wondering whether there might not be some way out for him after all, one of the men-at-arms went up to him and took his sword from its sheath.
Here, Blue Jay, take it.
The soldier who was holding his sword out to Mo was getting impatient, and Mo remembered the night when he had picked up Basta's sword and chased him and Capricorn out of his house. He still remembered just how heavy the weapon felt in his hand and how bright the blade caught the light.
No, thank you, Mo said, stepping back. Swords are not among the tools of my trade. I thought I'd proved that with the book.
The Adderhead wiped the honey off his fingers, removed a few cake crumbs from his lips, and looked him up and down.
Come on, Blue Jay, he said in a tone of mild surprise. You heard. We don't expect any great skill in sword play. All you have to do is run it through his body. It really isn't difficult.
Firefox was staring at Mo. His eyes were clouded with hatred.
Look at him, you fool, Mo told himself. He run you through with that sword on the spot, so why don't you do it to him?
Maggie understood why not. He saw it in her eyes. Perhaps the Blue Jay might take the sword, but not her father.
Forget it, Adder, he said out loud. If you have an account to settle with your bloodhound, see to it yourself. Ours is a different agreement.
The Adderhead looked at him with as much interest as if some exotic animal had wandered into his hall. Then he laughed.
Ha! I like your answer, he cried. Indeed I do. And do you know something? It finally shows me I've caught the right man. You are the Blue Jay, without any doubt. He's said to be a sly fox, but all the same, I'll keep my bargain.
And so saying, he nodded to the man-at-arms who was still offering Mo the sword. Without hesitation, the man turned and thrust the long blade through the body of his master's herald, so fast that Firefox did not even manage to flinch back. Maggie screamed. Mo drew her close and hid her face against his chest, but Firefox stood there, staring in bewilderment at the sword sticking out of his body as if it were a part of him. With a self-satisfied smile, the Adderhead looked around, enjoying the silent horror in the hall around him. Firefox took the sword sticking out of his body and pulled out the blade very slowly,